knows these situations where two, I mean, it's two men. I've never seen women do this at a bar. They start doing the thing where they puff up. It's almost like a peacock or, certain animals that kind of like, there's some frogs that like blow up their chest and certain birds. I don't know if titmice do it or what kind of birds. They kind of just start puffing themselves up and start almost chest bumping. And it's kind of like a battle to see who will back down first. That, which normally is at happening at bars, took place at the Republican primary debate. It's really, really wacky. The Times of Israel reporting near fight at Ohio Republican Senate debate between candidates Josh Mandel and Mike Gibbons. After Mandel repeatedly interrupts him, Gibbons accuses the former soldier of not knowing how investments work, which was that was a fair criticism, leading the latter to stand up and accost his rival. And we have video of this. If you're only listening, you'll have to imagine what it's like, although we'll have the clip up on our Instagram and on our TikTok. These are the front runners, guys, and we'll look at polling in a moment, but this is how cartoonish and childish and pathetic some of these races are. Check this out.
Never been in the fight.
No, you don't.
I do.
You've never been in the private sector in your
life. All right, gentlemen.
I've worked, sir.
Squat.
Two tours in Iraq. Don't tell me I haven't worked. Don't tell me I haven't worked.
You don't know squat.
It's okay, right?
You don't know squat.
Two tours in Iraq. Don't tell me I haven't worked.
Back off, buddy.
You back off.
Come on.
Never had a laugh.
Let's sit down.
Never.
Watch.
Watch.
We'll square it away with the wrong dude.
No, you're dealing with the wrong guy. You watch what happens.
Yeah, you watch what happens. So threats being issued. Now, I don't know. You know, you guys will have to tell me who comes off as the alpha male in that situation. It's genuinely hard for me to tell. And meanwhile, J.D. Vance, who did not participate in that, but is part of this race, sat to the side thinking, obviously, this really benefits me, although he's not polling that well. These are the front runners in the Ohio Republican Senate primary. We have the polling here. The latest here is these are average. Gibbons is polling 20. Mandel is at 18.7. So that's basically a tie. It's almost within the margin of error. J.D. Vance is down at 11%. And two other candidates, Timken and Dolan, are almost where J.D. Vance is, Patel with a point and a half. So that's an interesting race. And what's fascinating about it is the least delusional people. Well, I can't even say that. The most obviously delusional people are some of the ones doing the best. Mandel is an absolute lunatic. I mean, just a complete and total lunatic. And if you actually go and look at his political record, you see that this is just a massive, massive pro-Trump guy, and he has backed the election fraud claims of Trump. He says that the 2020 election was stolen. He says if he wins, he will carry forward Trump's agenda. Now, what's funny about that is it's not clear Trump really had an agenda other than just self-aggrandizement and putting himself in positions of power. He said the Trump impeachment was a sham. He will fight for the America First agenda. He says we will soon see the evidence coming out of the widespread voter fraud. I mean, that's verbatim what Trump says. And he's tied for first place, essentially tied for first place with Gibbons. So it's a very difficult primary to kind of make heads or tails out of because so many wacky people in there and they don't seem to be hurt by saying and doing crazy things. We'll see if the polling in any way is impacted. If anybody is going to benefit from that confrontation, you would think it would be J.D. Vance, although there might be Republican voters who like that and who say, no, I liked Gibbons before and I liked that Gibbons didn't back down, or I liked Mandel before and I liked that Mandel didn't back down, and they both puffed up their chests. At this point, I don't pretend to know what Republican voters are going to like, but we'll soon see it reflected in the polling.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
RCT Pittsburgh. meaty, and full of flavor since 1949.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I think what happens with these hearings is that this shows, you know, voters that they have a choice. What type of future United States do they want? Do they want one where the will of the people can be overthrown? Or would they like to continue to have fair and free elections?
After 10 months of meeting in private, the House committee investigating Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election and the deadly January 6th insurrection is holding its first public hearing tonight in prime time. Democracy Now! Will be live streaming it. As five members of the far-right Proud Boys are indicted for seditious conspiracy, we'll speak with the head of Right Wing Watch. But first, a top UN official is warning reports of sexual violence by Russian troops in Ukraine are rising fast.
Although there is never accurate bookkeeping on an active battlefield, it is clear that in the context of Ukraine, all the warning signals for the commission of atrocity crimes, including conflict-related sexual violence, are flashing red.
We'll speak to Pramila Patten, the UN Special Representative on Sexual Violence and Conflict, as well as the head of Amnesty International in Ukraine. And will air shocking testimony from a House hearing on gun violence. Speakers included an 11-year-old girl who survived the school massacre in Uvalde, Texas.
When I went to the barracks, he shot my friend that was next to me. And I thought he was going to come back to the room. So I grabbed the blood and I put it all over me.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House of Representatives approved a package of limited reforms to federal gun laws. The Protecting Our Kids Act passed Wednesday by a vote of 223 to 204, mostly along party lines, with five Republicans in support and two Democrats voting against it. The bill would raise the minimum age for purchasing semi-automatic firearms from 18 to 21, ban magazines of more than 15 rounds, and toughen penalties for gun traffickers and straw purchasers of firearms. The House approved the reforms after lawmakers heard hours of harrowing testimony from survivors of gun violence. 11-year-old Mia Cirillo described how she survived the Uvalde school shooting by covering herself in the blood of her friend and playing dead before using her dead teacher's cell phone to call 911. Also testifying was Zanetta Everhart, the mother of a survivor of last month's domestic terror attack on African Americans in the Tops supermarket in Buffalo.
To the lawmakers who feel that we do not need stricter gun laws, let me paint a picture for you. My son, Zaire, has a hole in the right side of his neck, two on his back, and another on his left leg. Caused by an exploding bullet from an AR-15. As I clean his wounds, I can feel pieces of that bullet in his back. Shrapnel will be left inside of his body for the rest of his life. Now I want you to picture that exact scenario for one of your children.
Police in Maryland have arrested a man they say plotted to kidnap or kill the Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. 26-year-old California resident Nicholas John Roski was reportedly found carrying a knife and a gun outside Kavanaugh's home in Montgomery County. Prosecutors say Roski was having suicidal thoughts and was upset by a leaked draft opinion showing the court's conservative majority prepared to strike down abortion rights under Roe v. Wade. Attorney General Merrick Garland promised a swift response.
Threats of violence and actual violence against the justices, of course, strike at the heart of our democracy, and we will do everything we can to prevent them and to hold people who do them accountable.
Senate Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell demanded the House immediately pass a bill to provide more security for Supreme Court justices and their families. McConnell continues to support a Republican filibuster of gun controls proposed by Democrats in the wake of the massacres in Buffalo and Uvalde. After 10 months of meeting in private, the House committee investigating Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election and the deadly January 6 insurrection at the Capitol will hold its first public hearing tonight in primetime at 8 p.m. Eastern. Democracy Now! Will live stream the hearings at democracynow.org. It'll be the first of eight congressional hearings, modeled in part on the 1973 Watergate hearings. We'll have more on the January 6th committee later in the broadcast with the head of Right Wing Watch. In eastern Ukraine, Russian forces have seized most of the devastated city of Severodonetsk, but Ukraine's military says its troops are fighting to hold the city's industrial zone. Earlier today, Russian forces fired on a Severodonetsk chemical plant where officials say civilians have been sheltering against Russia's assault. In Chernobyl, Ukrainian officials say nuclear radiation detectors are up and running for the first time since Russia briefly occupied the site of the 1986 nuclear disaster. This comes just days after a security camera at the South Ukraine nuclear power plant captured video of what appears to be a Russian cruise missile flying at low altitude almost directly over the plant's three active nuclear reactors. The United Nations is warning the number of people facing extreme food insecurity could soar to more than 320 million unless Ukraine is allowed to resume shipping grain, cooking oil and fertilizer through ports on the Black Sea. On Thursday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov met with his counterpart in Ankara, where the two discussed the Kremlin's plan to provide for a safe shipping corridor. After the meeting in Turkey, Lavrov said the onus to act was on Ukraine.
We've explained today that grain can be transported freely to its destination. Russia isn't putting any obstacles in the way. This requires Mr. Zelensky to give the command, if he is still in command of anything there, to allow foreign and Ukrainian ships to go into the Black Sea.
Ukraine was not invited to the talks, and officials in Kyiv have voiced skepticism over the plan. On Thursday, the head of the Ukrainian Grain Union said it could take months to clear sea mines from areas around Odessa and Ukraine's other Black Sea ports. A banking trade group warns U.S. and European-led sanctions are set to shrink Russia's economy by up to 15% this year. The Institute of International Finance said Wednesday the sanctions, quote, are unraveling Russia's economy, wiping out more than a decade of economic growth, and some of the most meaningful consequences have yet to be felt, unquote. The Biden administration says it's secured 10 million pediatric COVID-19 vaccine doses and is prepared to make them available to children under the age of five before the end of the month. An FDA advisory group will meet next week to discuss Pfizer's application for use of its pediatric vaccine. If it's approved, the first shots for children as young as 6 months old could begin by June 21st. Meanwhile, a panel of vaccine experts has recommended the FDA allow emergency use of Novavax's COVID-19 vaccine. Vaccine experts say the protein-based shots are highly protective against severe disease and death. This comes as NBC News reports U.S. states, territories, federal agencies, and pharmacies have wasted over 82 million COVID-19 vaccine doses. That's enough to vaccinate a majority of adults in Congo, a country where only 1% of people are fully vaccinated. Former President Donald Trump and two of his children, Ivanka and Donald Jr., have agreed to be questioned under oath next month by New York Attorney General Letitia James' office. This comes after the New York Court of Appeals ruled the trio must sit for depositions as part of James' civil investigation into the Trump Organization's business practices. The questioning will begin July 15th, barring a court intervention. The state of Arizona has put 66-year-old condemned prisoner Frank Atwood to death. after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected calls for a reprieve. On Wednesday, prison officials strapped Atwood to a gurney and injected him with a lethal dose of pentobarbital, stopping his heart. Jimmy Jenkins, a reporter with the Arizona Republic and former Democracy Now! Intern who witnessed the killing, said the execution team struggled to find a vein for around 30 minutes, prompting Atwood to twice suggest new places on his body for the team to try. Jenkins tweeted afterwards, quote, "I just watched Frank Atwood direct the state of Arizona on how to insert IVs into his veins properly so they could administer the drugs that would kill him," unquote. Atwood was the 39th person executed in Arizona since 1992 and the second in less than a month. Workers at a Trader Joe's supermarket in Western Massachusetts have filed for a union election with the National Labor Relations Board. If they're successful, the workers will create the first union at Trader Joe's, a company with more than 50,000 employees nationwide. Workers want health and safety concerns addressed and want to reverse recent cuts to their benefits. The employees seek to form an independent union called Trader Joe's United rather than affiliate with an established labor organization. And Belgium's King Philippe has expressed his deepest regrets for Belgium's abuses in the Democratic Republic of the Congo during the colonial era. King Philippe made the comments in Congo's capital, Kinshasa, Wednesday during his first official trip to the country, where he was welcomed by Congo's President Felix Tshisekedi. But the king stopped short of a formal apology.
The colonial regime was based on exploitation and domination. It was a regime of unequal and unjustifiable relationships marked by paternalism, discrimination, and racism. It led to violent acts and humiliations. On my first trip to the Congo, here in front of the Congolese people and those who are still suffering from it, I wish to reaffirm my deepest regrets for these past wounds.
Congolese opposition Senator Francine Miyumba wrote in response, quote, "In the face of the crimes committed by Belgium, regrets are insufficient. We expect an apology and a promise of reparations from him. It is at this price that we will definitely turn the page," unquote. Historians estimate up to 10 million Congolese were killed during the first 23 years of Belgium's rule, beginning in 1885, as King Leopold II ruled the Congo Free State as a personal fiefdom. Communities that missed their rubber collection quotas were made to provide severed hands instead, and King Leopold had Congolese people imported back to Europe for his human zoo. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we speak with a top UN official just back from Ukraine who's warning reports of sexual violence by Russian troops are rising fast. And we'll also talk to the head of Amnesty International Ukraine, who's been investigating war crimes by Russian forces since the invasion began. Stay with us. Flight, performed by the Ukraine National Symphony Orchestra. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The United Nations is demanding an independent investigation into charges of rape and sexual assault committed by Russian soldiers in Ukraine. Pramila Patton, the UN's special representative on sexual violence and conflict, told the UN Security Council Monday about an increasing number of reports of sexual abuse and human trafficking. On Monday, Patton addressed both the UN Security Council and the U.S. Institute of Peace.
We have all heard the accounts of horrific acts of sexual violence, reports of gang rape, rape in front of family members, sexual assault at gunpoint, women who have become pregnant as a result of rape, as well as the reports of refugee women and children being exploited by traffickers and predators who view this turmoil not as a tragedy, but as an opportunity to abuse the vulnerable. We have debunked the insidious myth that sexual violence in conflict is inevitable. Now we must demonstrate through proactive protection and empowerment efforts that it is indeed preventable. It is time to move from best intentions to best practice, to catch the women and girls who may otherwise fall through our safety nets. Let us not forget that while the eyes of the world are on the Ukrainian women and girls who are caught in the crossfire, who are living in terror in occupied territories, and who have been deported or forced to flee their homes and homeland, they are looking to us. We must not and cannot fail them.
Russia has rejected the accusations that its troops committed sexual violence in Ukraine. This is Vasilina Benzia, Russia's ambassador to the UN.
The ratcheting up of accusations of Russian service personnel committing crimes of a sexual nature since the very beginning of our special military operation in Ukraine has become a favorite tactic of the Kyiv regime and our Western colleagues. We all recall how in the Ukrainian and Western media, and also in this room, our soldiers were repeatedly accused of sexual violence with reference to certain reports containing allegedly reliable data. However, no evidence was provided.
We're joined now by two guests. Pramila Patton, the UN Special Representative on Sexual Violence and Conflict. She recently returned from Ukraine. Also with us, Oksana Pokalchuk. She is Executive Director of Amnesty International Ukraine. She's been investigating war crimes by Russian forces since the full-scale invasion began at the end of February. Pramila Patton, let's begin with you. You're just off your address to the UN Security Council. Talk about what you found in Ukraine.
Well, you will all recall that it was only a few days after the Russian invasion of Ukraine that the first reports of sexual violence began to surface. And as the conflict passes the 100-day mark, unfortunately, we continue to receive reports of sexual violence. I was in Ukraine from the 1st to the 5th of May, and I also went to Poland and Moldova. I did not meet with victims of sexual violence in Ukraine. I was in Lviv and Kyiv for obvious reasons, security. But I met with civil society organizations who were frontline service providers who have engaged with victims. I also met with families of victims. And of course, I met with government officials and signed a cooperation agreement. But what I can tell you is that the reports, credible reports from civil society organizations, but also from government officials like the Office of the Prosecutor General or the Vice Prime Minister, Ola Stefanishina, with whom I signed the framework of cooperation, shared a lot of information with me about brutal sexual violence being committed significantly against women and girls, but also against men and boys.
And Pramila, could you talk about the fact that, as many have pointed out, the number of incidents of sexual violence is likely massively underreported because a representative of the Ukrainian Women's Fund, for example, said that it's sexual violence in particular is a hidden crime because many women and girls will likely never come forward and report what's happened.
You are absolutely right. And that's why I didn't wait for accurate bookkeeping, hard data to react. And that's why I went to Ukraine, because we are dealing with a crime which is chronically underreported. And that's my concern. And for me, going to Ukraine was to send a strong message, especially to victims, to urge them to break the silence, because their silence is the perpetrator's license to rape. And as of 3rd of June, only 124 reports of sexual violence are of a verifiable nature and are being looked into by the human rights monitoring team of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. And that verification process is ongoing. And you can imagine that due to security and access constraints, the verification process is taking time. But 102 cases, perpetrators are reported to be Russian armed forces, and 2 cases from Russian affiliated armed groups. But for sure that we are only dealing with the tip of the iceberg, and this is why I signed the framework of cooperation and discussed with the government in Ukraine, but also in Moldova and Poland as refugee receiving countries, the need to establish safe spaces, which will be conducive, which will provide a conducive environment for the victims to report. Because due to stigma and a host of reasons, this crime is very much invisible.
I'd like to bring in Oksana Pukalchuk, a representative. You are the executive director of Amnesty International Ukraine. Your organization and you yourself have been carrying out an investigation on possible war crimes, including sexual violence, but broader war crimes in and around the area of the capital, Kyiv. Could you tell us what you found?
Yeah, sure. So the pattern of crimes committed by Russian forces in Kyiv region, and but not only, of course, that we have documented includes both unlawful attacks and willful killings of civilians. So we have to face it that a lot of killings and most of them were just apparent extrajudicial executions. So it was a straight will to kill people there.
And explain the areas you were in. Where all mm-hmm. did Amnesty conduct investigations of this nature?
Sure. Our last report was about Kyiv region. So we were in different areas around Kyiv and which were in occupation for more than 2 months. So it was Borodyanka, Bucha, Hostomel, Stoyanka, and many, many other cities and villages around Kyiv. So, for example, in Borodyanka, we found at least 40 civilians were killed in disproportionate and indiscriminate attacks, which devastated an entire neighborhood and left thousands. Really thousands of people homeless. So in Bucha, for example, we documented 22 cases of unlawful killings by Russian forces. And yeah, as I said before, most of them were apparent extrajudicial executions.
And how do you respond, Oksana Pakhalchuk, to Russia saying you haven't provided the evidence?
How I would respond? We have evidences. And as far as I know, there are a couple of cases that are already under the investigation by Ukrainian authorities, if you're talking about sexual violence, of course, because it's much more when we talk about other war crimes. But when we come back to the sexual violence, as far as I know, it's a couple of cases are under the investigation. So I hope that soon we will see an open and transparent court proceedings on the matter, and
protests will be bring to justice.
Pramila Patton, I wanted to ask you about the whole debate within Ukraine about how explicit to be. And you, I'm sure, have dealt with this around the world. I mean, there's been the firing of a human rights official in Ukraine for being extremely explicit about the rape of children. And there's a whole discussion within the human rights and journalistic community in Ukraine. Can you talk about how to talk about this?
Well, this is one of the area where my office and the United Nations system will be providing support to the Ukrainian government. And that's part of the framework of cooperation, which I have signed, that is providing support in the area of justice and accountability. We are dealing with a very sensitive issue, and we know why victims do not come forward to report, and one of the reasons being the re-traumatization and the re-victimization. And there are guiding principles on how to engage with victims, on how to document evidence and how to investigate. And one of the fundamental principle is the do no harm principle, which is extremely important. And this is precisely why I will be deploying, following the framework of cooperation that I signed on the 3rd of May, will deploy staff with expertise on sexual violence, documentation, investigation, prosecution. They will be embedded not only in the office of the High Commissioner's Human Rights Monitoring Team, but also in the Office of the Prosecutor General to support the investigation, to support the documentation, to support the collection of evidence before the evidence trail goes cold. This is crucial. There will be no justice if that stage goes wrong. And we have seen a lot in the past, whether it is in Iraq or with the Rohingya in Cox's Bazar, who have been interviewed, for example, over 15 times, with all the inconsistency that comes along, then making cases untenable in a court of law. So we want to reverse that culture of impunity into a culture of justice and accountability. We have to get it right. And I am very encouraged by the multiplicity of efforts to bolster justice, to bolster accountability.
And Pramila, could you say, you've said explicitly that any peace agreement, whenever it comes, should state explicitly that there will be no amnesty for perpetrators of sexual violence. Could you explain why you think sexual violence should be treated differently from other war crimes, and in what instances amnesty has been granted in areas of conflict where sexual violence has been prevalent?
Well, history has taught us that during multiple peace negotiations, the first item that has been on the negotiation table, where, of course, women are conspicuously lacking, the question of amnesty for crimes of sexual violence has always been on the table. And there are contexts where the option was women or peace. And as usual, women get sacrificed. So I am very encouraged by the fact that the Ukrainian government was very receptive to my suggestion of this area of priority, this pillar in the framework of cooperation be included, that in the event of any ceasefire agreement or peace agreement, that there will be specific provisions to ensure that there is no amnesty for sexual violence crimes, because war have limits, and international humanitarian law makes it very clear. And sexual violence can never be excused, can never be amnestied. And we have a solid normative framework with resolutions of the Security Council on the question of amnesty.
Oksana, there have been, of course, as you know, accusations of alleged war crimes, although, of course, much fewer in number, by Ukrainian forces. What do you know about those allegations, and what have you found in your investigations, alleged war crimes by, of course, Russian forces, but also Ukrainian forces?
We are now in a situation when a lot of territories where allegedly some war crimes were committed or now committing, they are under occupation. So we need to wait for the moment when we as Amnesty will be, and of course Ukrainian and international investigators will be able to reach this area and to do investigation on the ground. Because without being on the ground, without collecting proper evidences, it is impossible to say about war crimes. We can't, in my opinion, we can't presume it. Of course, there is no war where the one party of the war would be, will not violate international humanitarian law, and another part will. Of course, we have to face that. Of course, Ukrainian army, we will found these evidences. But so far, we don't have enough evidences to talk about in legal terms. So we have to wait for liberation of occupied territories, counter the territory, and just gather information, gather evidences there.
Pramila Patton, as we wrap up, Ukraine was already one of the leading countries in Europe when it came to human trafficking. You also have addressed this issue. If you can describe what you saw and how this issue should be addressed.
Well, with the displacement of close to 14 million people in the past 100 days, mostly women and children, with 6.8 million of women and children mainly having fled across borders, what I see is a human trafficking crisis within a humanitarian crisis. And human trafficking is not a separate issue. It is a symptom of a refugee crisis that breeds the exact conditions that human traffickers prey upon: economic impoverishment and a lack of better options. And we know from 2014, even in Ukraine and in the region, how human trafficking thrives. And human trafficking is one of the most serious organized crime of the day, transcending cultures, geography, and time. And we also know that predators and human traffickers, war is not a tragedy, it is an opportunity. What I saw in both Moldova and Poland, where I visited reception centers, is that the majority of the refugees are living with host communities. And there are grave security and protection concerns in both countries. These reception centers are run by volunteers with only a bare-bone presence of the United Nations agencies. There is a complete lack of oversight in terms of accommodation offers by private citizens, a lack of oversight of transportation arrangements. And these are really serious concerns. The reception centers, although the premises have been offered by the local government, they are being run by a multiplicity of actors volunteering to provide services. And from what I saw, they have little or no training or experience in supporting victims of trafficking or persons at risk of trafficking. And what is also clear, in all fairness, is that these refugee-receiving countries are overwhelmed, and they urgently need support to be able to allocate sufficient resources to support the responses, given that even service providers and NGOs have limited capacity to sustain an adequate and safe level of response. So I think what is needed, what is critical, is that the international community mobilize to ensure that effective protection systems are in place in all transit and destination countries and at all border crossings. And given the challenges of this transnational organized crime, as well as the very complex nature and multiple dimensions of human trafficking. The response requires an integrated and holistic response, a concerted cross-border response by humanitarian partners, law enforcement agencies, border forces, immigration officials, and political leaders. On Monday, when I briefed the Security Council, I urged for a regional European compact to be led by the European Council. And I have the firm conviction that this is what is required at this point in time.
Well, Pramila Patton, we want to thank you for being with us, UN Special Rapporteur on Sexual Violence and Conflict, and Oksana Pokalchuk, Executive Director of Amnesty International in Ukraine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We turn now from Ukraine to the voices of survivors of gun violence who testified Wednesday here in the United States on Capitol Hill before the House approved a package of limited gun reforms that's virtually certain to fail in the Senate, where Republicans have promised to filibuster. The House approved the reforms after lawmakers heard hours of harrowing testimony about the mass shootings in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas. Kimberly Rubio testified alongside her husband, Felix, describing the morning of the massacre at Robb Elementary School before her 10-year-old daughter, Lexi, was killed, one of 19 children and their two teachers who died that day.
On the morning of May 24th, 2022, I dropped Lexi and Julian off at school a little after 7 a.m. My husband and I returned to the campus at 8 a.m. for Julian's award ceremony and again at 10:30 a.m. for Lexi's award ceremony. Lexi received the Good Citizen Award and was also recognized for receiving all A's. At the conclusion of the ceremony, we took photos with her before asking her to pose for a picture with her teacher, Mr. Reyes. That photo, her last photo ever, was taken at approximately 10:54 a.m. To celebrate, we promised to get her ice cream that evening. We told her we loved her and we would pick her up after school. I can still see her walking with us toward the exit. In the reel that keeps scrolling across my memories, she turns her head and smiles back at us to acknowledge my promise. And then we left. I left my daughter at that school, and that decision will haunt me for the rest of my life. Somewhere out there, there is a mom listening to our testimony, thinking, I can't even imagine their pain, not knowing that our reality will one day be hers, unless we act now.
That's Kimberly Rubio testifying about her 10-year-old daughter, Lexi, who was killed. She writes for the local newspaper, the Uvalde Leader. Also testifying at Wednesday's congressional hearing was 11-year-old fourth grader Mia Cirillo, who survived the mass shooting at Robb Elementary and told the panel after the shooter murdered her teacher and friend, she covered herself in her friend's blood in case the murderer returned.
She went to go lock the door and he was in the hallway and they made eye contact. And then she went back in the room and she told us, go hide. And then we went to go hide behind my teacher's desk and behind the backpacks. And then he shot the little window and then he went to the other classroom. And then he went, there's a door between our classrooms, and he went to there and shot my teacher and told my teacher goodnight and shot her in the head. And then he shot some of my classmates and the whiteboard. When I went to the backpacks, he shot my friend that was next to me. And I thought he was going to come back to the room. So I grabbed the blood and put it all over me. And
what did you do then when you put the blood on yourself?
Just stay quiet. And then I got my teacher's phone and called 911.
What did you tell 911?
I told her that we need help and to send the police in our classroom.
if there was something that you want people to know about that day and about you, right? Or things that you want different, what would it be?
To have security.
Do you feel safe at school? Why not?
Because I don't want it to happen again.
And you think it's going to happen again?
That's Mia Cirillo, survivor of the Robb Elementary School massacre. When she was asked, does she feel safe at school, she nodded no. When she was asked if she thinks a massacre will happen again, she nodded yes. And this is Dr. Roy Guerrero, the only pediatrician in Uvalde, Texas, who testified about arriving at the hospital to treat the victims of the shooting. When he saw one of his longtime patients alive, he went outside to tell her parents. That's when they asked him about their other child who was a student at Robb Elementary. Dr. Guerrero described what happened when he went back to check.
As I made my way there, I prayed that I wouldn't find her. I didn't find Elena. But what I did find was something no prayer will ever relieve. Two children whose bodies had been pulverized by bullets fired at them, decapitated, whose flesh had been ripped apart, that the only clue at their identities was a blood-splattered cartoon clothes still clinging to them, clinging for life and finding none. I could only hope these two bodies were a tragic exception to the list of survivors. But as I waited there with my fellow Uvalde doctors, nurses, first responders, and hospital staff for other casualties we hoped to save, they never arrived. All that remained was the bodies of 17 more children and the two teachers who cared for them.
Dr. Roy Guerrero, the only pediatrician in Uvalde, Texas, testifying before the House on Wednesday. The Senate is weighing whether they will pass any gun reform bills. Next up, we'll speak with the head of Right Wing Watch about what to expect at this first public hearing tonight of the House committee investigating Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election and the deadly January 6th insurrection. Stay with us.
This angel sent here to change me, sent here to take me where I've never been. Long I have wandered, weary and waiting for something to shake me and life to begin. Holy water from my own. Come and save me where I lay. All this longing for beauty unnamed, it has broken me open to welcome the hope that you bring.
This angel by Jennifer Nettles. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. After 10 months of meeting in private, the House committee investigating Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election and the deadly January 6th insurrection of the Capitol will hold its first public hearing tonight in primetime at 8 p.m. Eastern. Democracy Now! Will live stream the hearings at democracynow.org. The next hearing is Monday. But tonight's will be the first of eight congressional hearings modeled in part on the 1973 Watergate hearings. Democracy Now! Will be streaming the hearing at democracynow.org. In a moment, we'll be joined by a researcher at Right Wing Watch, which is a project of People for the American Way. But first, let's turn to a video the group just released looking at one figure at the center of the coordinated effort to overturn the 2020 election. The video is narrated by Kristen Dorer, managing editor of Right Wing Watch.
Public hearings begin June 9th. For the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Among those who are likely to figure prominently in their findings, Ollie Alexander, the Republican political operative behind the so-called Stop the Steal campaign.
Let's terrify this town.
Right Wing Watch extensively investigated the Stop the Steal campaign ahead of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Here's what you need to know. So who is Ali Alexander? And what is Stop the Steal? On November 4th, 2020, Donald Trump falsely claimed that mail-in ballots were being used to steal the election, and he declared himself the victor. Waiting in the wings was Ali Alexander. He publicly launched Stop the Steal, a campaign to get right-wing activists to discredit mail-in voting, disrupt vote counting, and falsely accuse local officials of stealing the election. Ali Alexander served as the lead organizer. He called on his deep network of Republican legislators, political strategists, and far-right activists to join the effort. These were people he knew through his years in Republican politics and from his time as a member of the highly secretive Council for National Policy, whose influential members include the likes of Jenny Thomas. The campaign targeted Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, and Georgia, battleground states won by Joe Biden and whose cities are home to large Black and brown populations. Ali Alexander and his cohort held rallies and spread disinformation. Along with Trump, Stop the Steal falsely claimed voter fraud was widespread, even after Trump's own DOJ found no such evidence. So how did Ali Alexander and Stop the Steal contribute to January 6th? In mid-November, far-right members of Congress, conspiracy theorists, Christian nationalists, extremist groups, and Trump diehards came together under the Stop the Steal banner in Washington, D.C. Newly elected Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, and Madison Cawthorn addressed the crowd alongside organizers. Radical conspiracy theorist Alex Jones brought an InfoWars caravan. Members of the neo-fascist Proud Boys roamed the streets looking for fights and found them late in the evening. White nationalist Nick Fuentes and his America First group commanded the crowd's attention. Violent rhetoric became a key feature of these events. During a December Stop the Steal rally, Stuart Rhodes, the leader of the anti-government extremist group Oath Keepers, called on Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act and declare martial law.
That he does not do it now, while he is commander-in-chief, we're going to have to do it ourselves later in a much more desperate, much more bloody war.
In late December, Ali Alexander claimed credit for organizing the event that would take place on January 6th, along with three congressmen.
I was the person who came up with the January 6th idea with Congressman Gosar, Congressman Mo Brooks, and then Congressman Andy Biggs.
Alexander spent weeks leading up to the attack calling for rebellion. He even appeared to call for physical attacks on members of Congress.
To all these weak, need Republicans, I say, what would you do if somebody broke into your house and stole something and they were, well, I don't want to say stealing your front yard because I know what we do. Let's say they made it out to the road. I don't want to be accused of anything yet. Yet. Let them hear that. Yes.
On January 5th, Alexander held a rally by the White House. He said that the Stop the Steal activists were starting a rebellion against the deep state, and he began chants of victory or death.
Victory or death! Victory or death!
Ahead of January 6th, Trump had called for a wild protest at the U.S. Capitol. Alexander had used that to promote his own wild Stop the Steal rally at the Capitol. On January 6th, Ali Alexander was a VIP attendee at the Save America rally on the Ellipse.
We will stop the steal.
When Trump told the crowd to march on the Capitol, Alexander joined Alex Jones walking past barricades onto the Capitol grounds and up the Capitol steps, where Trump loyalists were fighting their way inside. The two retreated to a terrace overlooking the Capitol. Despite what he had seen up close, Alexander claimed that it was peaceful.
I don't disavow this. I do not denounce this. This is completely peaceful.
But he didn't stop there.
StopTheSteal.us is going to be the home of the rebellion against an illegitimate government.
So you're wondering, what's happened since? Ali Alexander went underground following the attack on the U.S. Capitol. He got kicked off mainstream social media platforms and lost access to Venmo, PayPal, Cash App, claiming Twitter trolls had taken everything from him. Last fall, the House Select Committee issued three subpoenas, one to Alexander, another to the Stop the Steal organization, and a third to Nathan Martin, an associate of Alexander's. In December, he testified for 8 hours behind closed doors. This spring, his lawyer said he would cooperate with the Department of Justice, but the next day, Alexander joined Alex Jones on his InfoWars show to suggest he wouldn't. Alexander has denied wrongdoing and has called Stop the Steal beautiful. January 6th, he said, was a government psyop, a conspiracy to prevent Trump from winning in 2024. His violent rhetoric hasn't stopped either. He mused to Alex Jones that there's time for legitimate violence when there's legitimate tyranny. We're likely to see and hear more about Alexander and his coordination with members of Congress at the House Select Committee hearings.
That was the voice of Kristen Durer, the managing editor of Right Wing Watch, which produced that video. Kristen is joining us now to talk about tonight's historic hearings. The hearings come as Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio and four other leaders of the far-right Proud Boys have been charged with seditious conspiracy over their roles in the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Also, one of the people who will be testifying tonight, we don't know everything that's going to happen at this first public hearing of the January 6th committee. But Nick Quested, who is a journalist embedded with the Proud Boys, will be testifying tonight. Kristen Durer, welcome to Democracy Now! You really laid a portion of this insurrection out right there. Can you talk about what you expect to see tonight, what you feel needs to be raised, and the coming together of this very serious charge of seditious conspiracy against the leaders of Proud Boys?
Yes, thank you for having me. I think what needs to be immediately addressed is that this attack was not a spur-of-a-moment event. I know the Select Committee will be looking at not just the events that happened on January 6th, but also the step-by-step efforts by Trump Republicans, Trump himself, and far-right activists to overturn the will of the people and to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Now, what I think we'll see today is that, as you mentioned, we have the documentary filmmaker who was embedded with the Proud Boys. He will be testifying, and he will be looking at the video and footage that he took while he was embedded with the Proud Boys during 2020. Now, the Proud Boys, five members of the Proud Boys, have been charged with seditious conspiracy. And the indictment by the federal government reads much like the indictment for the Oath Keepers in the sense that there was organized planning, they reached out to the leaders of state chapters, and they were willing to there was discussion of willing to use violence. So what we'll see today is particularly one moment, and that is the documentary filmmaker caught a moment when Joe Biggs, one of the leaders of the Proud Boys, who is facing seditious conspiracy charges now, he was speaking with an individual on January 6th in front of the barricades on the Capitol. After that moment, that individual went and confronted a police officer and knocked over a barricade. So that moment is seen as the turning point for the events that happened on January 6th.
Kristen, could you elaborate on what you think the public, what Americans are, the committee hopes that Americans will learn about the events of January 6th and whether those that opinions will be swayed by the information, new information that's reportedly going to be disclosed during the course of these hearings?
Right. So I think what the committee is hoping Americans realize is that this was not a spur of the moment event. And as much as some Trump Republicans will claim that this was just a minor riot, this was a very violent attack. Five police officers died as a result of that day. About 150 were injured. This was a very violent attack in which these Trump loyalists were calling for the hanging of Mike Pence. They were trying to hunt down Nancy Pelosi. They built gallows on the Capitol grounds. This was a very violent event. But I think what they'll also try to be making clear is that this was not just a spur-of-the-moment event. This was organized. The efforts to overturn the election was organized in the months ahead of time. They're going to focus on Trump's own personal culpability, what some members of Congress have done, along with those connections that Trump Republicans and have with these extremist groups who carried out the attack on the Capitol.
I mean, this is an incredible moment, Kristen Durer. This all has been happening basically secretly, this investigation, privately. I don't think it makes a lot of sense to the American public. So what are the key points? Apparently, you know, they interviewed like 1,000 people and videotaped most of those interviews, if not all. Ivanka Trump, apparently they will be perhaps playing clips of her. She was alone with her father for much of that day. President Trump, when everyone was texting in saying, you got to stop this, and he refused for hours. What do you think are the critical points that must come through tonight? I mean, it's being produced by a former head of ABC News.
So I think the critical points that will be coming through is the violent events, the fact that this was planned, you know, that is what we see in these indictments, was that this was, you know, conspiracy and that this was a planned attack. I think we'll see that that Trump and congressional Republicans and extremists like Ali Alexander, Republican political operatives like Roger Stone, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, that all of these groups worked to overturn the election by spreading disinformation and by truly wanting to overturn the will of the people. And they were willing to use violence to do so. And that they also had connections to some Trump Republicans. And I think what will happen is that these hearings will provide voters with a choice between those who will want to continue to defend free and fair elections and those who want to take away the will of the people.
And Kristen, finally, the Wall Street Journal has reported, and you suggested this earlier too, that the Trump supporters are planning a counter campaign, which will begin tonight, to dismiss the hearing as politically motivated, as an attempt to distract from the failures of the Biden administration, inflation, rising gas prices, etc. Could you say a little whether you know what exactly they're planning to do or say, this campaign, which is allegedly, reportedly going to begin tonight? And also, if the Republicans, as many say they will, take the House in the midterms, they're saying that they will absolutely end this investigation, the January 6th investigation.
Yeah. So immediately after the attack on the Capitol, we saw this about face by those Republicans who were aligned with Trump. They have been trying to downplay the event because it does not serve them well during elections. They have been trying to just sweep it under the rug, move on, forget about it, and critique Democrats. But the fact of the matter is that this was a serious assault on our country and on our democracy. And I think what we'll see from Republicans is, again, another effort to downplay it, deflect. They've claimed that this is a partisan committee, even though you have two Republicans on the committee, including, you know, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. And so they're going to claim that it's partisan and that it's a witch hunt, all things that we have seen. And they will try to focus on, you know, left, they'll say it's a, you know, it's a left-wing conspiracy of some sort. We've seen all this language before. This is nothing new. Immediately after the attack on the Capitol, a lot of Republicans started to claim that it was actually Antifa. This was carried out by Trump supporters who were fired up by Trump himself and by other extremist groups.
Finally, apparently Fox News will not be running this live, but maybe doing it as, quote, news warrants. And the significance of that, that some in the population will see this, others will not. That this is just the beginning of eight, and who the audience is. I mean, the American public, Merrick Garland, the question of whether the attorney general will move further and criminally perhaps indict President Trump. You have 20 seconds.
Well, first, I will just say that, yes, Fox is running counter programming and that it will be held by Tucker Carlson. And we know what type of news commentator Tucker Carlson is. So he will deflect and claim that that this is a witch hunt. But I just want to go back and say the bottom line to these hearings is that it will provide voters with a choice between those who want to continue to defend free and fair elections and those who want to take away the will of the people.
Kristen Durer, we want to thank you for being with us, managing editor of Right Wing Watch. Tomorrow, we will bring you excerpts of the hearing tonight. I'm Amy Goodman with the Marin Shake.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Real vinyl.
It's Amanda Richard here, and it's time for Whiskey Before Breakfast. Now, for the first time in 26 months, I can say, originating from the studios of WRCT Pittsburgh, but also heard on WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, Delaware, WTC and WTC HD1 Chattanooga, Tennessee, WKYW LP Kaiser, West Virginia, and Tube City Online Radio from Keysport, Pennsylvania. I've got a wild show lined up for you, and we'll see how it goes. First time in the studios in 26 months. We'll start off on the liquored up side of the family, and I've got a good old one to get us started. Here come Flat and Scruggs.
With the first guy you meet, and the only home you know is the club down the street.
Dim lights, thick smoke, and loud, loud music is the only kind of life you'll ever understand. Dim lights, thick smoke, and loud, loud music. Never make a wife to a home-loving man.
drinking and dancing to a honky-tonk band is the only kind of fly you'll ever understand. Go on and have your fun. You think you played it smart. I'm sorry for you and your honky-tonk heart.
Dim lights, thick smoke, and loud, loud music is the only kind of life you'll ever understand. Dim lights, thick smoke, and loud, loud music, you'll never make a world to a home.
Old man Peter was a mighty man. Where'd you get your liquor from, man downtown? Combed his head with a frying pan. Where'd you get your liquor from? Washed his face in a wagon wheel.